any issues, we got the text chat in the bottom. We'll be able to help you with the text chat there. And if you're having any issues at all, there's a X button. You click that at the bottom, and we'll be able to text chat with you and get you all the help you need. So let's jump into our session here. We'll do just a real quick little welcome and introduction. Get our slide loaded here. All right, so we're getting all set here. Sorry, we just had a little technical issue. This happens sometimes with computers, but we're good to go now. So we just want to mention that, we're happy to bring the webinar to you today here at WebJunction, and we've got just a couple of review things that we want to point out as we get started. These webinars are free, but they're not possible without all of you participating and attending, so we're very thankful to our presenters and all the folks that are attending, and also all the partners and customers of WebJunction. Without having partners and customers at WebJunction, we wouldn't be able to do these free events, so we're grateful that you're all here with us and partnering with us. So in line with the idea that we have tools that can help your library, we just want to point that out. And we also want to mention that every Wednesday, the first Wednesday of every month, we have a webinar that lets you get more information about some of the services that WebJunction offers that helps us get to the point where we can offer these free webinars. So we're thankful for that. And now we're going to jump into our content. More things that we're thankful for. Well, thankful for our presenters. Just a really quick introduction. I'm Michael. That's my little picture there down on the bottom. I'm WJ Library Man in text chat if you want to ping me directly. And then we've got Jennifer Peterson here with us. Hi, Jennifer.
Hello, everyone.
And Jennifer and I are going to be talking much, much less as our presenters take over, and we're going to be working the text chat and talking with everybody and paying attention and learning with the rest of you. We want to do a quick introduction. We got our first presenter here is Rebecca Judd. Hi, Rebecca.
Hello.
Rebecca is here in Washington at the Bainbridge Island branch of the Kitsap Regional Library. She's fairly close depending on your perspective, to the WebJunction offices here in Seattle. And we have two presenters also joining us from the Santa Monica Public Library, Rachel Foyt and Julie McDonald. Hi, Rachel and Julie.
Good morning.
Can you guys still hear us?
I can hear you now.
Okay.
All right.
So thanks, Michael. Julie and I are always happy to talk about the Living Library Project. We wanted to start off with how a Living Library works. The Living Library works like a regular library, except that people are checked out. Readers borrow living books for a personal conversation, giving people the opportunity to speak in private and personally to a stranger in a structured, protected, yet completely free space within a limited time. We chose 30 minutes for our checkout period, but it's up to you. We defined living books as people with a significant personal experience or a particular perspective on life. They are willing to disclose their life or viewpoint, debate, and discuss on controversial issues and answer questions. Readers are people interested in learning about the lives of others. There are so many reasons to hold a living library. First of all, you will get media and community attention. It's a great platform to promote your library and all of its services. It's also an opportunity to shake up how your community sees you. Be viewed as cutting edge and hip. The Living Library is an innovative public program that you can provide for your patrons with minimal cost. Also, we really see this as a gift to your community. The Living Library works to eliminate prejudices and stereotypes. In the two events that we have presented, we've seen the magic of this program.
One of the appeals of the program is that it can be tailored to suit the needs of your community. Staff at Santa Monica Public Library used our personal connections within the community and with community organizations that we've developed partnerships to recruit the living books. Our network then grew outward from there. We also tapped into our library and Friends of the Library Board for connections. Our collection development plan was specific to the needs of Santa Monica. Santa Monica has a high population of homeless people, so we trained and recruited three women to be living books. One was formerly homeless, a homeless advocate, and a woman in transitional housing, and those were some of our best sellers. Santa Monica also has a large community of Mexican immigrants, and immigration is a hot topic in Southern California right now, so we thought people would be interested in talking to a Oaxacan American. Another one of our bestsellers from both of our living libraries was Leslie, who was a fat activist, and she talked to people about what it was like to be her size in Southern California. Our first living library contained 14 living books, and our most popular bestsellers were The Fat Activist, A Feminist, A Formerly Homeless Person, A Nudist, and A Teenager. Our second living library in April had 18 living books, and we had most popular The Ex-Gang Member, The Fat Activist again, A Person Living with Mental Illness, and A Mormon. One of the first big lessons we learned even before our event was that our community wanted personal stories. We made a subtle shift from focusing on stereotypes and prejudices to focusing on personal stories. And we used these personal stories as the way to connect people in the community and as the inroad to exploring those stereotypes and fighting prejudices. This shift impacted how we recruited our living books. We switched our recruitment questioning from an emphasis on how individuals were stereotypical to how they wanted to tell their personal story.
When we began planning the event, we immediately knew that we wanted to have a training session for the living books. First of all, because this is such a unique event, we wanted to be able to meet all of the living books and have them meet each other. We wanted them to feel completely comfortable and competent the day of the event. We went over what they could expect, and it gave them a chance to practice telling their stories. Rachel and I didn't feel like we had the knowledge or the skills to cover the communication portion, so we worked with Jolinda Ramsey, a professor of speech and interpersonal communication, to develop training for the living books. Jolinda covered communicating effectively, getting the conversation started, diffusing negative, and answering challenging questions. This was one of our worst fears going into the project, that we would have some altercations. But it didn't happen at all, but we were glad that the books were trained on that as well. And Jolinda also covered evaluation and reflecting before the next reader. We held two 90-minute training sessions, and one on a weeknight and one on a weekend afternoon, and the living books only had to attend one. And we got great feedback from the living books about the training. They said it clarified for them what the day would look like and what the expectations were, eased any anxieties that they had, and helped them prepare to tell their story and point of view in a concise, engaging, and easy to understand way.
Julie and I knew that we worked well together, so we kept our staffing to a minimum, and we really tapped our community partners, our library and Friends of the Library Boards, for help recruiting our living books. In the beginning, Julie and I met every 2 weeks. Julie was in charge of the agenda, which was extremely important in keeping us on task and our goals clearly defined. As the project progressed, we met more frequently, and we also divided up the responsibilities. I handled the media portion while Julie handled the budget. Then at the event, we had more staff and volunteers to help us. We had 6 staff members and volunteers. One person was designated to handle the media, and we found that to be extremely helpful because you never know when reporters are going to show up or what their needs are going to be. They need to interview someone. So just having one person be the liaison was extremely helpful for us. We had 2 librarians to help readers select the living books at the checkout desk, and then we had 2 pages or runners that helped connect readers with the living books. We had one person maintaining and watching over the green room, and the green room was a resting space for the living books. And that person in the green room knew where the books needed to be and when they needed to be there.
I'd like to talk about budget for a minute. We had a very generous budget, but it could definitely be trimmed if necessary. We got a grant from the Friends of the Santa Monica Public Library, and we used their money to cover the training sessions. We looked for a local trainer, but we decided that Jolinda was the best fit, so we paid for her travel expenses. And we actually spent quite a bit of money on food. Because the Living Books volunteered so much time and energy and talent, we made sure to feed them well and to keep them comfortable. We spent money on the food for the training sessions, the day of the event, and the thank you brunch. We also spent the money, the friends' money, on decorations and tables the day of the event. We really wanted to have kind of a festival atmosphere, so we thought that money was well spent. And we spent just a few hundred dollars on ads and local papers to help our turnout. We used our $1,400 from our regular library funds to cover t-shirts. I saw we had a question about t-shirts. We had the Living Books wear t-shirts the day of the event, and then we offered t-shirts to every person that checked out a Living Book. We felt that this was a great marketing tool. We knew that we were going to do the program again, and we just thought it would be nice to have people out and about in the community wearing the t-shirts and getting questions about them. We also used our library funds to cover a professional photographer. We knew that we wanted quality photos the day of the event to be used for future purposes, and we didn't want to have to worry about taking them ourselves.
So prepare for media interest in your event. We had strong media interest because of the unique nature of the event, and that included local on-site reporters as well as national and international coverage with an Associated Press article and a documentary by the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation. Think about who your target audience is for your Living Library. Ours included community members, and we focused on new users or those who do not frequent the library, our library and Friends of the Library Board, the news media, and elected officials. We developed media talking points to have all the information at our fingertips when we were talking to reporters. And this was extremely helpful, particularly when we were interviewed by the Associated Press. It's not every day the AP calls, and we were a little nervous. it took us a long time to come up with our elevator speech, which is the short, pithy few sentences used to describe the event. I really suggest coming up with that elevator speech and giving it to everyone involved in your event, your Living Books, your volunteers, so that they can describe the event in a clear, concise manner. We also sit pre and post press releases, and as Julie mentioned, the photographer was valuable to help capture the spirit of the event, and we used photographs from the event that were on the front page of our local newspaper. We had them for post-event publicity, presentations to community groups, and for general library publicity. We asked our Living Books to sign a photo release waiver before the event, and we posted signs about filming and photography on the day of the event. Julie also taped a PSA that ran on our city TV for 2 weeks before our event. So it was really helpful for us to develop a press kit to hand out to reporters and interested people on the day of the event. And our press kit included the press release, a list of frequently asked questions, the Living Book catalog, the Living Library guidelines, some general information about our library, and our contact information. We also developed speaker series and talked to neighborhood organizations and boards about the Living Library, and we really involved our local service organizations as our partners. Julie even posted a notice on our library Facebook page. So I encourage everyone to take advantage of social networking and use whatever you have, a blog, Twitter, or if you're just simply linking to your community partner's website.
Okay, I'd like to go over of the nitty-gritty of the actual event day. We had over 250 participants for our two events, and that meant that we had to be super organized and coordinated. Our first event was a four-hour event from 12 to 4 p.m. on October 18, 2008. And our second Living Library project was 5 hours 11 a.m. to 4 p.m. on April 18, 2009. How we did it. Our climate, we're very lucky. Our climate allowed us to have the event outdoors. For the second living library, all of our living books were in our courtyard. We really liked having all of our living books within eye shot and all together. When we split them up in our first living library, readers got lost, and it was harder to keep track of the books and their breaks. So we had tables in the courtyard. All of the tables had the book title and the table number. The tables also had clocks, so the living books and readers could keep track of the time and know when to wrap up a conversation. As Rachel mentioned, the event was staffed by six library staff members and volunteers. We had a green room just for living books available throughout the day. That's where we met before and after the event and where the books took their breaks. We had comfortable chairs and tons of food and drinks to help them keep them rested and keep their energy levels up. One staff member was stationed in the green room at all times, and we had walkie-talkies to communicate with the checkout desk. We had a spreadsheet schedule, and we posted that in the group that Jennifer was talking about, and it had all of our living books and 30-minute time slots. We gave the book the option of one or two 30-minute breaks. In terms of the actual checkout procedure, we had a checkout desk on the first floor of the library and had balloons and signage to attract attention. Some people came just for the Living Library project, but some people were just walking through the library, and we wanted to give them an opportunity to hear about our events as well. Each reader had to assign event guidelines, which went over the event rules and had them agree not to harm or damage the living book. They received sample questions in case they had trouble getting the conversation started. We wanted them to be able to reference the piece of paper with some questions that we thought would really get things moving. Because we booked up early and readers were allowed to make two bookings, it was helpful to have appointment cards with the table number, the book title, and the time for people to take away, so they would really know which table and which book they were meeting with in half an hour, and they wouldn't have to come back to us. And that's posted too in the group. We had catalogs available to check out, and that helped readers select who they wanted to check out. We tried to make the description short, interesting, and inviting. And that's in the group as well. If the reader was heading straight to a living book, we had escorts deliver them to the correct table. And that really cut down on the people kind of wandering around and just made it seem to flow better.
Julie and I feel that reflection and evaluation are necessary for a successful event. Sit down after the event and discuss what you did right, what went wrong, what could have been better. The feedback from the living books was extremely helpful in crafting our subsequent living library. We asked for feedback on all aspects of the living library project, from recruitment to training to the event itself. Both the living books and the readers remarked on what a worthwhile experience the living library was. And readers, we were concerned that they might not come with questions, so that's why we had our sample questions, but they really had thoughtful questions for the book. And both the books and the readers were impressed with the quality of the conversation. One participant wrote on her blog after the event, "Speaking with the homeless advocate was a revelation, very informative and emotionally profound." And we thought, wow, that's what the Living Library is all about.
So Rachel was saying about us reflecting and evaluating, we learned so much after the first event, and again, even more after the second event. After the success of the first Living Library, we decided to expand it to 5 hours, thinking, we can't get enough of this, let's just make it even longer. However, we found that 4 hours was really the perfect amount of time for us. As I mentioned before, we found it very helpful to have the living books in eyeshot. The second time when we did this, it just made everything feel so much smoother and less chaotic. And we've said this several times, but you will get media attention. Have your talking points, your statistics, and your elevator speeches ready. We cannot emphasize that enough. The Living Books reported at our thank you brunch that they felt the sample questions were extremely helpful and that they should also have a copy at their table just in case. And then something that we found super important was about recruitment. I saw we had a question about if the books were volunteers. They absolutely were. We just paid them in food and T-shirts. and recruitment takes so much longer than you think. You want all of your books to be bestsellers, so start very early. We thought that when people heard the concept, they would be falling over themselves trying to get involved. But it really took, you know, a lot of emails and a lot of calls and dead ends and then going in different directions to get all of the books. And we found the books through personal connections and community partners. I have a question about that. And we just really used our networking skills. We didn't want to get into interviewing people and advertising for the books. We wanted to have a little bit of quality control in our first couple of events. So we just knew friends of friends or a city employee that works with certain individuals. So that's how we got them. And finally, people are very enthusiastic about the experience, and many come up after they've met with a living book, and they wanted to know when we were having the program again. So we really wanted to at least give them a month or say, you know, check back in 6 months, something like that, so that they knew when to expect it, because we really wanted to build on our success.
So I think that's it for us today, and we'll be able to have some questions after Rebecca does her presentation. So we'll turn it over to you guys.
Jennifer, would you like me to get started, or do you have a PSA? Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you, Jennifer and Michael. And everybody at Web Junction, it's a real pleasure to be part of the program today. And as an introduction, I'd like to say that Santa Monica and Bainbridge Island were part of the U.S. launch of the Living Library, and we ended up with programs almost by happen chance that were 1 week apart. Santa Monica on October 18th and Bainbridge Island on October 25th, 2008. But for most of our 4 month long planning period on Bainbridge, we didn't know there was another program in the works at Santa Monica. And when we did figure this out just a few weeks before the event, we were so excited. We contacted Rachel and Julie. We talked with them about our process, some of the things that our own group had struggled with, and they were also very kind to lend us some of their day of the event documents. So I'd like to start out with a thank you to Santa Monica for all that help and support. Today I'm going to be talking about the history of the Living Library, how to get started. I think there's a lot to consider before embarking on this program. I'll talk about a sample budget. I'll share with you a timeline that worked for us, and in particular, how we recruited our living book. And then I'll talk briefly about the day of the event. And then finally, what the program meant, and Julie and Rachel mentioned some of this too, for those involved and how we celebrated. And then I'm also happy to answer any questions at the end. Okay, Rachel and Julie talked some about the concept of the Living Library, but I'd like to take just a minute and talk about its history. The Living Library was founded in 2000 by Danish anti-violence organizer Ronnie Abergel. And in essence, that's a picture of Ronnie up in the top corner. In essence, he was sort of dialing back to the belief that people who are talking to each other, who are engaging in dialogue, are not harming each other. And more broadly, then, the Living Library is a program that fosters understanding where there is misunderstanding, and works to build bridges between people who might not otherwise have a forum for conversation. And most commonly, these are festivals, the Living Libraries are held in festivals or public library settings, And over 30 countries have hosted a Living Library to date. And in the United States now, it's 11 states. Okay, getting started. This is the website for the International Living Library Organization. And up at the top, you'll see a tab for organizers. This is where you can read about hosting an event and also where you can download the application form and the Living Library Organizer Guide, which is really key reading. It's about 70 pages. Why a Living Library? For me, after looking through the website and reading the Organizer's Guide, this is the very first question to ask. This is a program that requires a great commitment, literally, you know, hundreds of hours, but in return, reaps great rewards. I think it's a really, it's a serious program, and it's a thoughtful program. And by its very nature, you are going to be asking your community to take a journey with you and to, in some ways, step outside of your collective communal comfort zone. And in a deeper way, this might be something we can discuss, I think you are actually leveraging some of the trust that people place in their public library as an institution when you engage in a program like this. And I read an article in a library journal recently that talked about public libraries as places not only of information, but transformation. And the Living Library is squarely a transformative program. People are really changed by this experience, and I've really come to consider it to be humanities programming at the highest level. So I don't want to scare anybody away, because having seen this program in action, I am such a believer in it. But I do think it's important to be thoughtful about why you are taking your public library in this direction. For us, we also had a reading tie-in, which really grounded the program for us. At the same time we were planning for this program, we were planning an October countywide read of Harper Lee's To Kill a Mockingbird. So the Living Library provided a terrific framework to dig deeper into the questions raised by To Kill a Mockingbird. So it provided a structured environment to look at our own stereotypes and our own misconceptions in our communities today. And this was the line from To Kill a Mockingbird that we used in all of our press releases and, you know, kind of as a tagline for our program. And this is Atticus Finch, who says, "You never really understand a person until you consider things from his point of view, until you climb inside of his skin and walk around in it." Okay, getting started. Building an advisory committee. So Bainbridge Island is a community of 23,000 people. We are, an island. We're a ferry ride to Seattle. So 23,000 people, it's a smallish community. And to the degree that 23,000 people can be pretty close-knit, this is a close-knit community. So we knew that if we wanted something, this somewhat out-of-the-box program to succeed in our city, we needed to involve a lot of people. So our first order of business, once we had read about and committed to the program, was to build an advisory committee. And I can't stress enough how important this approach was for us and how key it was to the success of our event. In my mind, the effort spent building this committee paid dividends really tenfold as we started our way through the program. So why do this? The Living Library provides an opportunity for the library to work with new partners, and Rachel and Julie mentioned this as well. Our advisory committee included representation from a group called BJAC, the Bainbridge Island Japanese American Community, the Just Know Coalition for Teens, the City of Bainbridge Island, the mayor's office was involved, Interfaith, our Historical Society, and then our Arts and Humanities Council. And this can be a difficult program for people to conceptualize. Even in our own advisory committee, and we talked about this program for hours and hours and hours, it took a long time for our understanding of the program to coalesce. Make new friends personally and professionally. Our group really bonded over this event, and those are relationships that continue to be important to me. So lessons learned about building this committee. It's hard to describe this program to newcomers by email. We sent out, emails to our community leaders asking them to be involved, but really it took a lot of phone calls and in-person meetings to bring people to the table. And if at first you don't succeed, try again. This would be probably my biggest recommendation if you're planning to build an advisory committee. Meaning that if there are key groups in your community who seem unwilling to commit to this project because it can be kind of difficult to conceptualize, keep at it. You know, find the gatekeepers. At our table, we felt the absence of actually two key constituents, the school district. We just were not able to recruit a teacher or an administrator for this project. And also the Suquamish tribe. This tribe is our neighbors to the north. And recruiting someone with publicity and press experience right at the beginning would be very helpful. You're going to want to be able to describe the program well to your community. The Living Library is a great program for lots of reasons. One is that it's not very expensive to put on. We got $1,000 from two grant sources. We had a Humanities Washington Quick Grant. They gave us $500. And our local Arts and Humanities Council also gave us $500. We used half of it, the $1,000, for catering, the Living Look books. We wanted to, again, feed and take care of them. And we had an orientation session and dinner for them there. And then immediately following the event, we had lunch. And then we had some breakfast food before our event day. $100 for travel expenses. We did, all of our books were volunteers, but we did comp people who were coming from the Seattle area, and we paid for ferry tickets. We only spent $100 for our photography costs, but I would spend whatever in your community is needed. We had a student who was connected with somebody in our advisory committee, a college student who was a photography major, and she took fabulous pictures. It's kind of like a wedding. You really want to have somebody with a good eye capturing those moments. $200 printing, graphic design, and publicity, and maybe $100 on clocks that we had from Target, photo development, and thank you gift. So here was our, I have a number of slides here that are sample timeline. And what we did, we planned for at least six 90-minute meetings for our advisory group. And we did a little work before the meeting. We all read the Living Library Organizer's Guide. We discussed the purpose and the intended outcomes with our library boards and our library administration. And we worked on assembling our core advisory group. So that was sort of the pre-process. And then meetings one and two, so once we had our advisory group there, we did a general orientation to the Living Library program. And it did kind of take two meetings. We first of all, we discussed the history of the Living Library, how it works, the reason for the project. We finalized our advisory group between those first two meetings, who else should be involved, who do we need to have at the table. We set the time and the date and the place for the program at those very first meetings. So things to consider, is it going to be in the library or at another site? If it's in the library, is the library opened or closed? General setup, who is going to be there? And we chose to have this event at the library on a Saturday morning when the library was closed. The readers signed up for conversations in our meeting room, and then they were escorted through a connecting door to the main part of the library where the living books were seated at various tables. And we consulted throughout our planning process with Ronnie Abergail, who was the international organizer for the Living Library, and he felt strongly that it was better to hold this program, just as a point of information, at a time when the library was open so that people could have sort of a spontaneous time to come in and talk with books. But we had trouble making that work in our crowded library without disrupting normal library business. So we did choose to have our event at a time when the library was closed. And he also suggested an interesting thing, which was that incoming readers, so the people who are coming to your program to participate, should really be in a separate room or place from the living book, so that sign-up decisions were not influenced by visual cues. And so we did follow this advice, and we used two separate spaces, the meeting room for registration and then the library. Okay, meetings 3, 4, and 5. So I don't know if this would be necessary for future living library planning groups, but we devoted at least 3 entire meetings to the living book recruitment process. In particular, we had to decide as a group how to approach this project. Were we interested in living books who had interesting stories to tell, or living books who have been the object of stereotyping or misunderstanding? And I've come to think of this as sort of the living history, living library continuum. And in the end for us, after much discussion and certainly much hand-wringing and a lot of reflection on our book, To Kill a Mockingbird, again, that was something that we kept in our thinking at all times, we chose to embrace the questions and the opportunities of that original concept of the living library. So in essence, we took a collective deep breath and we jumped in. And so we also needed to figure out an approach to recruiting our living books. These are the things that we talked about. You know, were we in fact perpetuating stereotypes by asking people to become living books? And what if we offended people in our community by asking them to participate? So we had these sort of questions, and in the end, we decided on the following approach, which I've listed here, which really worked well for us. For 1 month, we ran a short call for living books notice in our community newspaper, and this notice described the project just briefly, listed the Living Library website, and invited interested people to contact a Gmail account that we set up. So in this way, we felt like we were not limiting our selection of books to those members of the community we happen to know, nor were we making assumptions about who might or might not feel misunderstood or stereotyped. So then respondents to this Gmail account were asked the following questions: what intrigued you about this program? In what ways have you felt stereotyped or misunderstood? Why do you want to become a living book? And what would you be interested in reading at a living library? And then based on the answers, we try to determine if the person, you know, really understood the intent and the purpose of the program, and we extended our invitation. So then also within our advisory group, we recruited individually. Over the course of several meetings, we worked on a list of possible living book titles, and we were really seeking a balanced collection. I think that's really important. To look for that balance, just like you would in a book collection, of occupations, lifestyles, and points of view. And then we worked from this list to brainstorm individuals in our networks who might be good fit for the program. And for us, whenever possible, we looked for living books within our community or our county, because we wanted our program to be a conversation among neighbors. And another thing I would say is that at all times we tried to really be clear and direct with our potential living books about what was involved and the level of commitment needed. So books were asked to attend an orientation meeting, and they were asked to submit a living book title and a brief catalog entry, and of course to attend the program itself. And we just felt it was very important for the living books to ultimately name their own titles and to describe them for readers. And here was our final catalog. We had 19 living books, an African-American father's perspective, an anti-violence activist, that was Ronnie Abergale, who attended our program, an atheist, a Baha'i faith practitioner, and then so on. We had a female cop, we had a raw foodist, we had a young gay man, we had a quadriplegic, we had a Marine FBI agent. So our last, I skipped one. Okay. Well, I'll just put another thought in, which is that we, our last task as a planning committee was to get the word out. And Rachel and Julie talked about this as well. To our embarrassment, it really did not have a formal media or publicity plan. And to the degree that our program did generate a lot of publicity, I would just have to say that we were more lucky than good. I mean, we did some of the things that we always do. We put flyers in the community. We sent press releases to our local and our area news outlets. We made presentations as part of our To Kill a Mockingbird reading program. But what really worked we had a reporter from the Seattle PI who picked up our story and ran an article one day before the event. We had somebody from our advisory committee had a connection with somebody in our local NPR affiliate in Seattle, and so we were able to get a last-minute interview. One of our organizers, Kathleen Thorne, and Ronnie Abergail, who was the international organizer who attended our event, they did an interview. And then our advisory network, one of the great things about having an advisory network was they really utilized their own social networking and their own email list to bring people to the program. And one good, one secret about the Living Library, I would say, and I don't know if Rachel and Julie will feel the same, but you really don't need to have a lot of people to attend to make the program a success. We had only around 60 readers for our first event, but because they checked out more than one book and over the course of the 3 hours, you know, every title turned out to be a bestseller. We didn't have any blank spaces, and we were at capacity the whole time. And in fact, at the end of the program, we ended up putting small groups together, groups of two or three with our living books, and that was a good thing, too. 5 days before the event, that's this slide, we held a living books orientation. So this was our agenda. We had dinner. We chatted a little bit. We talked about the history of the Living Library. We had a guideline for our living books. I actually think this is something we borrowed from Santa Monica, and that's a handout on the Web Junction resource guide. We talked about how to prepare being a living book, and we also had handouts for that. We did not have a formal trainer for our program. Our organizers managed this orientation. We talked about how to create a catalog title and an entry. And we passed out photograph and press release forms, and then we answered lots of questions. So, and now we've got the day of the event. So the time of the event, we only had 3 hours, 9 a.m. to noon, and setup for this program was relatively simple. We pulled apart tables in the library, and we set up 19 conversation locations. You can kind of see that in the picture there. And at each table, we had flowers from our library garden here, just to make it a sort of a cafe atmosphere. And we had a small clock, battery-powered clock, so that readers and living books could pace their conversations. And then in the meeting room, we had a registration table near the door that had a sign-in sheet that looked like a series of library cards. And after readers were registered, we gave them a set of guidelines to read. And then copies of our catalog were placed on tables, which were set up in the meeting room. And we had a checkout table in the middle of the room with librarians sort of standing ready to assist. And then at that checkout desk, each catalog entry had a piece of paper with lines for six circulations, you know, 9 a.m., 9:30, 10, 10:30, 11, and finally 11:30. And then like Santa Monica, we limited the number of holds to one per person so that the greatest number of readers could participate. We didn't think of calling our escorts pages, but that's a great idea. At the appropriate time, we had volunteers who would take the readers to the living books in the main part of the library. And I rang a school bell every 30 minutes for timekeeping. And we were dogged about getting evaluations from our books and readers. We really hounded people as they were leaving to fill out evaluations for us. And people were really happy to do that. And so I've also included on this slide one of our catalog entries so that you could have an idea of what these were like. And I've also included our whole catalog on the resource guide. And I'll tell you that reading the catalog just cover to cover, those three pages, it's really moving. I think it's just a wonderful document in itself. but I'll read this one. Looking like the enemy, a Japanese-American internment survivor, I was 7 years old when Japan bombed Pearl Harbor in 1941. Our family was part of the group of Bainbridge Islanders who were the first to be exiled from their West Coast homes to desert concentration camps. As an adult, I realized I spent much of my adolescent years trying to prove I'm an American by denying my cultural background and putting away the World War II experience. Today, I am an open book. So they were very powerful statements. Lesson learned from our first living library. I would say care and feeding of living books. That was a concern for us. We just really wanted to make sure that our living books who were really putting themselves out there for us were taken care of. Our event was only 3 hours, so our books didn't really need a long break, but they did end up needing a couple of minutes, as you could completely understand, between readers to really kind of collect their thoughts and have a sip of tea or have some water. We had a table that we had set up with food and water for our living books, but I think, you know, just as a hosting fine point, I would probably put those, you know, some water and, you know, cookies or so on each of the conversation tables. Longer time period. This was something that our living books and our readers suggested, that they had just started to get into a conversation after 30 minutes and the time was up. A more interactive checkout. A lot of our checkout for that first living library was sort of express check. And so the librarians were there to assist, but people kind of signed up themselves where they wanted, who they wanted to talk to for their conversation partners. And then most common advice from books to readers. This was interesting. The book said to our readers, be yourself, be open, and don't worry about prying. Don't be afraid to ask challenging questions. And that was really validating for us because we really wanted to, our books really understood what the program was about, and they were really encouraging our readers, as, you know, at the same time we were, to really take this opportunity to ask the questions that they don't normally get to ask. That's kind of what the program's about. Okay, there's a lot of thinking and planning that goes into a living library, but when you see how this program changes people, it's all worth it. And here were just a few reflections that are some of my favorites that people wrote to us as readers in their evaluation. There's too much to write or even fully know yet. Many hours of thought will go into my absorption of this experience. The conversations change assumptions I didn't even know I had. I'll see the landscape that I drive differently personally, and old lesson reinforced, to listen is to know. And finally, yay, our, you know, event was a cause for a lot of celebration and a lot of thanks. We had a feature article in the Kitsap Sun. Our readers sort of spontaneously sent letters to the Bainbridge Review. We had a couple of weeks of you know, thank yous in the newspaper. We had a little bit of a shout out in Library Journal, which was fun. And we got on a Web Junction blog, so thank you to Web Junction for that. And we had a celebratory lunch. All of our organizers got together at a restaurant in town a couple weeks after the event, and we shared stories and we shared pictures that we had gotten back, and that was really nice. We had really gone through this process together. And we had a thank you lunch right after the event and sort of a debrief time for our living books, but we followed up with a photograph and a thank you to each of our living books for being part of this sort of launch program. So thank you very much for being a part of this session today. And I've included all of my contact information here, and I'm so happy to talk about the Living Library with anybody that has questions after this program.